Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now in depth on what the House, the Senate, and Robert Mueller want to know about Russia and why. As Ken Rudin and I noted, this is the week that former FBI Director James Comey testifies before the Senate Intelligence Committee about his interactions with President Trump regarding Russia. Subpoenas have also gone out from the House Intelligence Committee to former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and to the president's longtime lawyer. As Comey reveals what he knows and investigations into the Trump White House associations with Russian leaders deepen, we thought it would be valuable to give you some clarity on what it's worth paying attention to. So we've asked a guest who's been following the investigations closely to take my questions and yours for the remainder of the hour. What are you concerned or curious about regarding the special counsel Robert Mueller's probe, the congressional investigations, or what James Comey might say? All questions are welcome here. I know it's confusing. There's a lot of allegations swirling around, and I think Molly McHugh will give us some clarity on that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Molly McHugh is an expert on international relations. She's a writer for publications like Foreign Policy Magazine, and she's with us today from Washington. Molly, welcome. It's really good to have you back on the show. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me on. Happy to do it.
Could you explain, since so much has happened since the FBI director was fired, could you explain what his role was before he was let go into the Russian investigation? Where was he at? What was he doing?
Well, as the head of the FBI, you know, Comey, while not directly overseeing the investigation on a day-to-day basis, would have been in charge of everybody working on that portfolio. From the beginning of sort of the announcement that the Russians had been trying to interfere in the U.S. elections, this is a portfolio that the FBI is partially responsible for, sort of looking at foreign interference and domestic counterterror or sort of counterintelligence and other operations. From the beginning, he's been very engaged on this. Obviously, he had a very high profile in the elections last year, sort of looking at both sides. And I think he's a personality that people have been paying a lot of attention to, and his dismissal from the FBI and the manner in which it was done and sort of the attempts to say, well, it wasn't about the investigation, and then the president coming out and saying, no, it was exactly about the investigation. It's really been a whirlwind couple of weeks of news that have left a ton of attention on former Director Comey, and I think he is really going to be in the hot seat this week when he goes up to the Hill.
What you just said there reminded me that Ken Rudin said that Robert Mueller will be listening very closely to what Comey says. Is that right, and why?
I think that's true. I think there's sort of different portfolios within the investigation that sort of on a day-to-day basis are hard to keep track of. There's kind of all of the what was Russia doing questions. There's the, okay, the Russians were doing these things. What were they doing with anyone from the Trump campaign or any other Americans? And then there's kind of the what else was going on. And then subsequent to that, you have what is becoming an increasing topic of focus, which is attempts to sort of influence or interfere with the investigations and interfere with the justice process moving forward. And if history is any indication, it's that last portfolio that is actually the most problematic and the easiest place for political personalities to sort of step into it when they're trying to avoid these types of investigations.
Tell me why.
I think, especially for this president, who seems to believe that being in the White House holds him above the law, and he has made this statement in many different ways, saying he's sort of outside the Constitution and ethics and other things don't really apply to him. I think he really believes he should be able to pick up the phone and call the director of the FBI or have him in for dinner and say, hey, Michael Flynn was a good guy. Can't we just drop this investigation? And it should just go away, that this should influence the direction of things. And this is interference in justice. And he should know that. If he were a more trained political personality prior to entering the White House, he probably would have some indication of this. But I think the thing that's the most remarkable is, I mean, Trump has incredibly high paid lawyers working for him at this point. The president has the White House counsel, has outside counsel, has many people giving him advice. And apparently he's just ignoring all of it. And he continues to tweet. He continues to make statements about the investigations publicly and privately. And all of these things are much more likely to get him in trouble in terms of what is reviewable or prosecutable or viewed as over the line by people on the Hill who are looking at these things than more likely anything that is likely to come out in a short amount of time on any of the Russia investigation issues.
Okay. We have full phone lines for you, so I want to get to some calls here to Jonah in Great. Minneapolis. Hey, Jonah, your question for Molly. Hi.
Hi. My question is, can Trump use executive privilege to prevent James Comey from testifying? Because I know there's a bit of a discrepancy as to whether or not, because Comey is, as of now, a former government employee.
What's your understanding of that, Molly?
It seems like this is something everybody is trying to figure out right now. And this morning you had Kellyanne Conway from the White House come out and say, well, if Comey testifies, then we'll all be listening closely. My sense is from sort of the Washington rumor sphere that they will allow the testimony to proceed because they understand that stopping it would be a really, really, really damaging public signal. I think what Comey will actually say publicly, because it is a public hearing, it is a very different question. I do think that he will, in sort of broad strokes, recount conversations with the president if asked. I do think he will, in broad strokes, kind of discuss some of the issues with the different investigations that are ongoing. But, you know, this is a hearing that's driven by questions from senators. And you had this amazing hearing with former CIA Director Brennan 2 weeks ago now, I guess, on like the 24th of May, where the questions to him from both parties were so political and so focused on narrow agendas that his response to all of them was essentially, hey, people, there's been an attack on our country, and maybe we should pay attention to that.
Yeah.
And I think that this is sort of, for the intelligence community and for others who follow Russian interference and Russian influence operations on a day-to-day basis, it is so clear the patterns of behavior and activity that have been going forward. And the sort of partisan response to this, the overall kind of reaction of, so the Russians interfered in the election, big deal, is really astounding to the people who are working to secure our country on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's why you see the sort of increasing pressure of leaks and sort of documents coming out and statements coming out, because people are incredibly frustrated that the people able to review what happened in the election, to review what the Russians were doing, have really not done so in a way that I think the intelligence community views is adequate yet. And certainly no one is informing the American public about what's going on.
Okay, two questions to follow up on what you just said. You're saying that the leaking that's happening is because there is a lot of internal dissent about the way President Trump is handling specifically the Russia stuff, but a lot of these international and domestic relationships. And this is a way to have your say, you know, on the other side of that, or what?
I think there's sort of three categories of leaks. One is that it's frustration. It's people who believe, people within the intelligence community who believe that the right things are not being looked at by those in the power to do anything about them. So some of it is that. I think some of it is an effort to put information into the public sphere because there are individuals working on these portfolios who are worried that no one will ever know or that the evidence will be disappeared. You sort of had this amazing, another leak from the NSA last week, where it was sort of put out that the current director of the NSA had like an agency-wide town hall teleconference/meeting. and basically said to everyone, everybody needs to preserve these categories of information and go back through all of their own collection and everything else and look for information on XYZ relating to the Trump-Russia investigations, but more specifically Russia and what Russia is doing in the United States, because they're trying to be sure that that's documented. But I think the third category of leaks is very much disinformation, for lack of a better way to say it. And it's sort of hard to know which are well-intentioned people who believe information needs to be made public for reasons of security or other, and then people who are just trying to muddle the understanding of what's going on and muddy the waters. It's a very mixed bag.
Molly McHugh is with us if you've just tuned in, and she's an expert on international relations and on Russia. You will find her writing in places like Foreign Policy magazine. We asked her to spend some time with us to give us some clarity ahead of former FBI Director James Comey's testimony on Thursday. And as I say, welcoming all questions here about the special counsel, Robert Mueller's probe, the congressional investigations into Russia influence in our elections, with the Trump campaign and some of these other issues that have come up, and then perhaps on what James Comey might say. Full phone lines. You can reach me on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, and we'll get to some of these questions right now, and then the lines will open, and hopefully we'll get to yours. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, to Robert in Golden Valley. Hey, Robert. Hi.
Hi. I'm interested to know if the Congress is able to compel the president to testify before Congress. And if so, when is that likely to happen? Because I want to see him perjure himself before Congress so we can get this over with and get a real president.
Ah, okay. Molly?
Well, I think the answer is yes, but I still think it is. I think if you see the political environment in Washington right now, after the dismissal of Flynn, after some of these more recent activities, I think the pressure is really off. Despite what we see in the media, there is no appetite in the House, which would be the primary body responsible for dealing with anything to go forward. There's no appetite in the Republican caucus to deal with any of this. Almost everyone just wants it to go away.
But it isn't going to, is it?
No, it's definitely not.
Okay. A major in Stillwater called to say, at what point in this will this witch hunt that's based on hearsay be over? When will we let Trump run the country? Now that word witch hunt is something, Molly, that the president uses in a number of tweets about this. I mean, do you believe that that's a widespread view among Republicans in Washington and perhaps some of the other political supporters of the president's?
I think in Washington, no. I think amongst the supporters of the president around the country, absolutely. And I think if you're on Twitter, if you're on other social media, these sort of conversations happen in your feed all the time in response to things that are going out. I think there's sort of portfolios of debate that everybody's being unfair to the president. Nobody's giving him time. I think a common sentiment is sort of overall, you know, who really cares about this Russia stuff anyway? Does it really matter? And that, I think, is where you see this reaction from former intelligence heads, from current intelligence heads, from the head of our military services, from others who deal with Russia on a day-to-day basis and have to look at what they do and what they believe and what they are trying to do to the United States of America and its society and its citizens and the West and our allies. This sort of total disbelief that nobody with the power to do anything about what is happening has said anything about it to the American public. And I think a good contrast to that is if you saw in the recent French elections, just before the final vote, I mean, the Russians had been doing all sorts of information and disinformation campaigns before the vote there as well, had openly supported Marine Le Pen, a sort of crazy far-right candidate. But right before the election, there was sort of another data dump of hacked documents. And the response was so different, where you had the French government and French authorities and all of the political parties, absent Le Pen, coming out and saying, this is an attempt to influence your vote. Do not let it influence your vote. Go vote, no matter who you're voting for. You know, don't let it influence what you're thinking about the election. But really telling society, telling French citizens, this is what's happening, and this is how you should see it. That is an incredibly valuable tool. And I think, you know, we're all so jaded in the U.S. Mm-hmm. about authorities and statements from authorities. We think we're all immune to these things. It really matters when your leaders come out and say, hey, you need to understand what's going on, and it's important that you see it. You know, from the beginning, from sort of just after the election with Trump, I wrote a piece on this in January for Politico magazine. The really remarkable thing is that any president of the United States should care what the Russians were doing in our election, one way or the other. Let's look at it. Let's see what they did, because they built sophisticated information architecture that can still be used to influence American society and American opinion, and they're using it, and they're doing it now. And the fact that there's been so little comment from this White House on that, and not even about whether it helped them or not, just saying in general, this is something that we should be concerned about. We need to look at it. It's a foreign power trying to influence how our country is shaped, and we don't like that. Trump can still do that. It doesn't seem like he will, but he should.
Did you watch any of Megyn Kelly's interview with Putin last night?
Yes, it was a good popcorn TV for all of us that work on Russia.
I mean, then you saw him say to her, "What do you mean we interfered with your election? What have you all lost your minds over there?" I mean, he was so contemptuous and basically dismissive of a lot of these allegations. Is that for his own domestic audience, or is that for us?
Well, in the community, we like to say that you never believe anything until the Kremlin denies it. And once they do, you know it's probably true. I think this is for both audiences. I think publicly, of course, they have to say, and you've seen a number of Russian officials saying, oh, this is nonsense. Of course, we would never do these things. Yet at the same time, 2 days before, he had made a statement at a conference saying, maybe it wasn't us. Maybe it was, quote, patriotic hackers who
right.
decided to try to influence the election. They know what they're doing. They speak very openly. If you look at the ideologues around the Kremlin, if you look at the sort of guys writing military doctrine and strategy for the Kremlin, they're very open about the fact that this is the primary means of war, as they defined it, that information and influence operations are an ongoing strand of war against the West and against NATO and against America. And they are not going to ease off of that. I mean, in their calculus, they view it as like a 3-to-1 ratio of effort. Like, it's much easier to put time and effort into news and fake news and information and disinformation than it is to, you know, have to fight a war or build an army or invade something. And they've gotten very good at the political influence, and they're going to keep on that way.
You know, I think when you wrote that political article in January, we had you on the show, and I've never forgotten you talking about, I've kept this in the back of my mind as all this Russia stuff has developed, you talking about how the best thing that can happen for Vladimir Putin are credibility issues, right? All these questions, the swirling, well, can we trust the elections? Can we trust these alliances? In that way, he's getting just what he wants. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. I think, you know, the chaos is sometimes a means and a goal, both. And if you look at the domestic situation in the United States, the sort of paralysis with policy and with legislation and with the Hill and with the administration, if you look at the churn sort of amongst our alliances and amongst different international relationships, all of this creates a landscape where the Kremlin is much more able to operate because they're very focused on specific things right now, where the rest of us are just sort of spinning around. I think another one of the great Putin quotes from the last few days, I think also in response to a Megyn Kelly question, you know, she sort of asked, well, do these squabbles amongst the West help you? Is this what you want? And he sort of looked at her and very deadpan said, if the squabbles are going to dismantle NATO, then absolutely. And this is a long-term Russian goal. They're very open about it. They do not hedge when they talk about it at all. They want NATO to fall apart. They believe it is a threat to them. They believe it is a threat to their power. And so when you see events like the last few weeks, where there was a story that came out today in Politico that it was the president himself who removed reference to Article 5, which is the collective defense statute sort of within the NATO treaty. He sort of removed reference to that himself from his speech, to the surprise of his cabinet and national security advisors. When you have these reports about the president giving classified information to Russian officials in the Oval Office, when you have sort of this series of events of, it seems like that's the one thing he's really focused on, to the detriment of U.S. security most of the time, there's a lot of questions that we should be asking about that, because, I mean, the NATO alliance is the most successful military alliance in history. It and the intelligence sharing sort of related to it, especially from Five Eyes, which is sort of the English-speaking country's intelligence sharing apparatus, is the thing that keeps the United States of America and its people the most safe, even if we don't see it on a day-to-day basis. And everything that disrupts that relationship, that causes everybody to question that relationship, that makes people wonder whether or not the United States of America will be there in case of attack, aids the Russians. And I think some of the stuff from the president this weekend, his very strange response to a terrorist attack in London, adds to this list of uncertainty in our European allies. And it's something the rest of his cabinet is working hard to offset in many respects. But right now, Putin is very happy. Absolutely.
Yeah. If you've just gotten in on the conversation, had a chance to stream us or turn on the radio in your car, Molly McHugh is with us. She's a foreign policy advisor and expert on Russia. And you read her writing about this in places like Foreign Policy Magazine and Politico. And we've asked her to come in and give us some clarity around all these swirling allegations, the upcoming testimony of James Comey, some of the ways that President Trump is reacting to this, and the debate that's going on in Washington around Russia. 651-227-6000 if you have questions about this. Maybe not so many political questions on this. You know, trying to get to the geopolitics on this with Molly. 651-227-6000 and 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. To David in Bloomington. Hi, David. How are you thinking about this?
Well, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm trying very hard to keep an open mind with the whole process here, but I'm confused, and I'd wonder if you can share some of your insights. It sort of sounds like you see what you look for, and I haven't heard any evidence that there is any mechanical tampering with the election from not one precinct around the country. But yet we seem to have pretty clear evidence that public opinion may have been strongly influenced to the extent that the voters took responsibility by staying away from the polls. So if we're looking in the wrong place, how do we continue to carry on this discussion saying we're looking for election tampering when it was opinion influence?
Molly?
It's a really good question, and it's exactly the right question. I do think there are sort of individual cases that have been raised of sort of electoral issues that are worth review. I think that's always true in any country having elections, but I certainly think that's not what people are focused on. And for the most part, it's not what the argument is in terms of what was happening in the election. But I think that, you know, since sort of there was this long progression of Russian learning. I think really you can look at 2008, just after the Russian invasion of Georgia, as a turning point in how they were viewing their power in the world. It was a moment when they realized their military was crap and they had to do a lot of things to sort of revitalize and reform their own armed forces, which they've done. It was also a time when they sort of rethought a lot of other things. The election of President Obama was something they paid very close attention to. It was really when they started looking at the idea of social media as a tool to reach and mobilize voters. You saw the Russians experimenting with some of those technologies that are mostly American. I mean, in terms of the experts on some of these things, they were learning them by hiring Western firms. You saw them experimenting with it again in Georgia in 2012 in the elections there. And I think you've really seen them move forward. And for them, this is like the ultimate hack, essentially. If you can hack people, which is really, in base terms, what they are trying to figure out how to do with sort of a culmination of a century of psychological operations and intelligence operations and information operations kind of coming together with this perfect platform of Facebook and Twitter to sort of mobilize them all and get them in front of people very quickly from sources that are totally suspect, that most people don't even bother to question. But you can really shape the information environment around individuals in ways that you never could before. And this is something the Kremlin is paying a lot of attention to. But it's also true of people who work on elections anywhere. You had, I think, the one actual interview from the president's advisor, Jared Kushner, and his son-in-law after the election was in Forbes magazine, where he sort of talked about this amazing data operation they had built for the elections. There are a lot of very strange things in that interview, but I think that a few things worth noting. The Trump campaign openly brags about running voter suppression operations through social media. This was the main focus of what they were funding during the campaign. They weren't really doing positive advertising. They were doing voter suppression campaigns. They're talking about targeting down to not just sort of demographic categories. Okay, they don't want younger women voting. They don't want Black people voting. But down to individuals, that they were profiling people down to the individual level to target advertising and information to them. This kind of stuff is incredibly creepy. I think most Americans would not be okay with it if they understood what was going on. Most of it is private sector technology. It's not something that's sort of classified or secret. But the kinds of information space shaping that is happening, it's totally new and it's totally creepy.
But what's interesting about what you're saying, Molly, is as you're describing that, I'm thinking, you know, companies that make products that they want us to buy do that kind of stuff. Now, maybe it feels creepier, and a lot of us have gotten used to that. Target does it. Maybe it feels creepier when it's about voting, but I think we've all kind of gotten used to the way we're going to be marketed to online and from big companies.
Well, and that's exactly it. You know, if we're sort of comfortable with the idea that companies, and almost all of this is based on marketing and advertising logic at its core. But while we have no problem with the internet showing us a pair of shoes that we might like, or a pair of shoes that we were looking at last week, or a pair of shoes that we might find next week, understanding that exact same thing is happening with news, with political views,
right,
with other content. And we're not paying enough attention to this. And they're sort of, you know, since the election, there's been all this discussion with Facebook and Twitter and others that they're going to stop fake news and whatever else. Nobody's going to stop fake news from those companies. They're making billions of dollars a year on advertising and paid content. They are not going to turn that spigot off. The rest of us need to figure out how to deal with it.
Here's the other thing that I've been thinking about as I think about the testimony and the questions that are going to happen in public on Thursday. I mean, the very nature of the transparency of these investigations, and by the way, of our democracy at large, seems to be something that is very valuable to the Russians. Is there something to that?
Absolutely. I think, you know, one way or the other, the Russians can put a good spin on things. They know how to comment. They know how to interfere. I do think if you look at, there's been this sort of strange merger of headlines and content amongst sort of, if you look at RT and Sputnik as kind of the twin pillars of the Russian disinformation space in terms of, you know, the actual media outlets, but sort of a merger of content from those into far-right news outlets in the United States, Breitbart and InfoWars, and some of the newer ones that I don't even really understand. And then a bleed from that into Fox News, which is sort of the mainstream conservative news in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
This is how information spreads. And this is the goal of the billions of dollars that the Russians have spent in media and news, is to get what is obvious disinformation and propaganda from propaganda platforms into other media with very little question, and sort of the advancement of narrative and story and content. Absent the Russian label, no one's going to say, hey, we got the story from RT. But there's been a lot of this going on, and the president watches that stuff. And this is all something we should be concerned about.
For our listeners' knowledge here, RT is Russia Today, and Sputnik is another basic mouthpiece for the Russian state.
And Sputnik is really the worst in terms of the conspiracy theory spreading, yes.
Phone call here for you from Peter in St. Paul. Hey, Peter, hi. Thanks for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Yeah, no worries. I just have to take issue with your guest a little bit. The first thing is independent Sanders supporter, and one of the things I'm concerned about is there's a long history in the United States of finding external influences and really using it to some pretty nefarious things. You don't have to go any farther than the 1950s to look at it. I'm curious. Data scientist, I've actually done the content analysis on the side. Over 70% of the references in the news cycle is that she that Putin has hacked the election to the point of the prior power. It wasn't hacking people; it was hacking the election. The other thing, like RT, for instance, it's a mouthpiece. There are a lot of mouthpieces. It also happens to be probably the biggest advocate of fighting climate change. It has James Hansen, the former NASA meteorologist, who was excommunicated from the federal government on all the time. So I'm not sure that we can be as clean in assigning these affiliations as we can, and I think it's a little bit disingenuous to do that. RT has far exceeded, for instance, the American media in calling out the failure of the U.S. to respond to climate change,
okay,
which actually is counter to Russia.
Molly?
Hey, it's a totally fair question, and I think an important thing to understand here is that the way that Russian information operations and influence operations work is, again, the chaos. It's not just the right. The Russians have cultivated relationships on the left for a long time. A good example of this, and there's been well-documented cases of this across Europe and the United States, the Russians were funding a huge number of green causes, especially anti-fracking campaigns from environmental NGOs, because they believe that the production of oil and natural gas from other means is a threat to their market. And so for them, this is, you know, let's throw some money over there. Let's support green causes. They don't really care about these things. It's more about their bottom line. And it's sort of understanding that it's never going to be one ally, one cause, one thing that you can really put a finger on. They will support or not support a range of causes based on their own interests. And certainly there are many people who would find individual stories on RT, on Sputnik, that they agree with. Certainly right now, a lot of them are in this space about climate change. But this is, you know, this is another instance where the message from the Kremlin, and that's what RT and Sputnik are, the message from the Kremlin. The message from the Kremlin is America is ceding its leadership in the world. America doesn't want to play by international law, international rules. America has no moral right to lead or to have authority. And whether you agree with those things or not, obviously they are closely linked to Kremlin policy. And I think when we see any White House, this or previous, stepping into issues where the Kremlin sort of gets to hold up a flag and wave it around and say, haha, we told you we were right, it's not a great thing. And I think that, you know, you can't, obviously we, the United States of America, can't make every decision on policy based on whether or not the Kremlin would like it or not. However, I think when you're talking about, hey, you know, Russian propaganda has done a number of great things, you know, Russian propaganda also supported WikiLeaks and this whole range of actors that we now understand are connected to Russian intelligence for a long time. And you had the left and others sort of championing Assange and Snowden and others until they realized that this is very targeted intelligence operations against the West.
You know, I have about 2.5 minutes left, but yep. I want to say this. It is clear in listening to you that you take in a lot of information from a lot of different news sources. I think there's nothing wrong, right, from reading a lot of opinion and reporting from a lot of different places. That's valuable if you understand the agenda with which something like RT and Sputnik and some of these other places are reporting this news on. But isn't it valuable to know what they're saying?
Absolutely. And I think that's really the most important thing, is to understand underlying it what the pillars of Kremlin policy and global ambitions are, And then understanding that these that information is the primary front in what they view as a global war. It is the first step toward anything else is softening opinion, changing opinion, realigning opinion. And across the West, sort of creating dissent, questioning government. And again, I'm not saying that everybody should be totally loyal to a government everywhere unquestioningly, but inflaming these types of things where you have, you know, there were Russian activists and protesters at the Dakota Access Pipeline protests doing I don't know what. There were, you know, Russian, quote, news crews in many of the sort of racial, you know, anti-police protests that were happening in the United States in the last few years. They find these ways to sort of dig in and look for opportunity. And it's not just information a lot of the times. There's also an intelligence angle. There's also the mobilization of militia groups, of sort of violent causes as well across Europe and in the United States. And when you sort of look at the tiered way in which they approach relationship building and influence, it's something we really need to pay attention to. It's not just about opinion. It's about trying to destabilize everything that we value as societies.
Molly, this is super valuable for us. Thanks so much for taking the calls from our listeners and my questions, and I hope we'll talk again. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Molly McHugh is a foreign policy advisor and a foreign policy expert on Russia. If you got in into the middle of that conversation, as I say, this whole discussion waiting for you when you're ready on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.